Now, historically speaking, we may say Buddhism in England falls into three phases. There's obviously the past, then there's the present now, and then, of course, there's the future. Let's consider each of these in turn. First of all, the past. Many people don't know it, but Buddhism has been known in this country for well over 100 years now, well over a century. Before that, of course, there was complete, one might even say fantastic, ignorance of Buddhism in this country, as in all the other Western countries. I remember, according to one early writer whom I read, I think it was at the beginning of the last century. I mean, he wrote at the beginning of the last century, not that I read him at the beginning of the last century. According to that writer, the Buddha was none other than the Egyptian god Apis, which, of course, is the Egyptian bull god, the white sacred bull. So the Buddha was identified by one early Orientalist with Apis. During the second half of the 19th century, however, we may say, this dense ignorance began to be dispelled. During that time, there were in this country a number of very distinguished Oriental scholars, whom we usually call Orientalists. The first of them, the earliest of them, was Spence Hardy, who made a special study of monastic life in Ceylon. This study was published more than 100 years ago. Then there was Childers, who was for several years Governor General of Ceylon, who learned Pali, who translated Buddhist scriptures from Pali into English, and also compiled the first Pali English dictionary. And then, of course, there was Rhys Davids, the great Rhys Davids, who inaugurated the systematic translation as well as publication of all the Pali Theravada texts, and who also launched the even greater dictionary, Pali Text Society's Pali English Dictionary, besides founding the Pali Text Society itself. So these three great scholars, these three Orientalists, Spence Hardy, Childers, and Rhys Davids, these, of course, were all workers in the field specifically of Pali Buddhist studies. At the same time, we had in the field of Sanskrit Buddhist studies Max Müller. His life work, of course, was rather the study, the edition and translation, the Rig Veda and various other Hindu works, but he also devoted a considerable amount of time and attention to Buddhist Sanskrit texts, Mahayana sutras and so forth, and translated a number of them himself. Then for Chinese Buddhist studies, there is the well-known figure of Beale, who published his Catena of Buddhist Scriptures nearly 100 years ago, including material which is still very valuable indeed. These are just a few, just some, of the greatest names in these fields. There were also translations of works on Buddhism by various continental scholars made into English. A number of Buddhist texts, scriptures, were also translated into English about this period by various scholars working in or from different languages. One might just mention in passing Bigande, Bishop Bigande, an Anglican bishop in Burma, who compiled an enormous work from Burmese and Pali sources on the life and teachings of the Buddha. It's a little out of date now, as you can imagine, but it still is quite a valuable work and a very worthy effort for its time and period. So in this way, a great deal of the Pali canon came to be translated into English, and a large number, well, at least some, Mahayana sutras. And knowledge about Buddhism, knowledge of Buddhism, began to be introduced in this country. On the whole, we can say, though, that there were very serious, very considerable limitations. This knowledge derived from these books and translations, was on the whole confined to scholarly circles, either the circles of the professional Orientalists, or people who were working in the East or living in the East and had an administrative interest in the religions of the people over whom they were ruling, or else students, professional students of comparative religion in this country, or students of ancient thought, and so on. So even though a certain amount of knowledge was disseminated during the latter half of the last century, it was mainly limited to these more scholarly circles. An important part was, however, played by the Theosophical Society. The Theosophical Society, as many of you know, was founded in the United States in 1873 by Madame Blavatsky and Colonel Olcott, and it very quickly spread to this country. The Theosophical Society had, and still has, three main objects. First, the formation of a nucleus of universal brotherhood. Secondly, the comparative study of religions. And thirdly, investigation of the occult powers of man. So with these aims and objects, with this very broad platform, the Theosophical Society did help to spread in this country, as elsewhere in the West also, quite a number of Buddhistic ideas, sometimes in a slightly garbled form, but that was perhaps inevitable at that particular time. One great merit of the Theosophical Society's work, at least, was that it familiarized people with the idea of Buddhism as a living religion. The Orientalists, the Oriental scholars, tend to present Buddhism as something dead. That's the impression one often gets from reading their works. But the Theosophical Society did make it quite plain, make it quite clear that Buddhism was a living religion, and that quite intelligent people could follow it. It wasn't just an Oriental exotic curiosity. About the same time, Edwin Arnold's very famous poem on the life of the Buddha, that is to say The Light of Asia, published in the 70s of the last century, did a very great deal of good work in spreading some knowledge about the Buddha and his teaching. This work, this poem, is still a bestseller. I believe it's run into, so far as the original publishers alone are concerned, practically 100 editions, which isn't bad. So much for the latter half of the last century, with the work of the Oriental scholars and the Theosophical Society, followed by Edwin Arnold.